this is not, it never has, nor will it ever be, a deeply philosophical podcast. I think we've pretty much established that. But this week's topic of ghosts, just in case you didn't read the title of the episode when you downloaded it, is really interesting to me because I think if we proved that ghosts were real, that would have probably the biggest impact on human society as a whole. Because, like, and I know what you're thinking, well, what about aliens, bro? We'll get to that in a second. But, like, if we prove that ghosts are real, that means that we know for a fact that something happens after we die, all right? That means there's a religion, more or less, that's probably right. Which one is it? We don't know. We don't know yet. All right. Whose God is the real God? But that's what's interesting, because a lot of people called atheists don't believe that that's even possible. All right. But if you believe in ghosts, then you also inherently do believe that there is some sort of afterlife. All right. How detailed you get with your afterlife and the rules for it and all of that vary, obviously, and no one really knows. But it would throw society on its head because, good God, imagine, all right, it would be crusades and jihads and holy wars all over again because everyone would be like, no, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. And no, we don't know. We don't know who's right. All right. Now, quick sidebar on the aliens, and then we'll get into ghosts. But, like, if aliens exist, like, yeah, that'll freak a lot of people out. But religions will quickly adjust. All right. You will have every Southern Baptist preacher quickly point to some vague scripture in the Bible and be like, yeah, God created aliens. It was right there the whole time. We are supposed to minister to those aliens. All right. Here we go. Praise Jesus. Amen. Look, right here, Numbers 34:18. And God created those and those that are not. That, what is an are not? That's people who aren't people. Praise Jesus. Can I get a hallelujah? Amen. All right. Why do preachers talk like this in a weird cadence with, I don't know, and then they keep doing it, and then they make words, and then they start sweating, and they try to get people to respond to them, and then they say amen and hallelujah, and then they start to get all showy with their hands, and I don't know. Anyway, all right, we are way off track. Let's start the show.
Our weird world.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson, and I am so sorry about that intro. I don't know where that came from, to be honest. I'm highly caffeinated right now, I can tell you that. So that's probably got something to do with it. But yeah, we're talking about ghosts today. We're not talking about anything else. We're not getting religion involved. We're not going back to that whole alien debacle. That's going to be for another time. That preacher will 100% come back when we do an alien episode, probably. No, this week we are talking about ghosts, continuing our Halloween theme. Another big episode this week. Six more stories, just like last week. We're looking at the stories of Maria Martin, the Blue-Blooded Ghost, the Greenbrier Ghost, Old Book, James Chafin, and Teresita Bassa. All right, I've rambled long enough already. Let's jump into story time. Story time. Our first ghost story starts in England with the story of Maria Martin, who was the daughter of a mole catcher in Suffolk, England, or a village in Suffolk, England. When Maria was 24, she met 22-year-old William Corder. And by that time, Maria already had two children with two other men in the village, but one died as an infant, so she still had one. Corder, however, was known as the village bad boy. He even went by Foxy, which, weird. He also was known for fraudulently selling his father's pigs and forging checks, which I find interesting. I didn't realize they had checks back in the 1800s, but yeah, I guess it makes sense. since Maria was basically the village whore at this point, because this is like at least her third sort of gentleman caller, but she really didn't have much of a choice when it came to the men in her life. And so she decided to just sling some leg for this guy, for Foxy. And she eventually gave birth to their son in 1827, though it also died in infancy. So she's one for three at this point. Not great. Despite the bad luck, Corder actually planned on marrying Maria, which is nice. It's good. It's a good mature move there. He suggested the two meet at the Red Barn, where he planned to elope with with Maria Martin to Ipswich. That is what it is called. It is called the Red Barn, I guess, because it was the only Red Barn anywhere around. It was a landmark. People knew what it was. Maria, who was frightened by this news, she was not ready to leave home and go elope with this guy. She also thought it would just be a dumb idea to walk out in broad daylight. And so Corder told her to dress in men's clothing and meet him at the barn anyway. Corder then left Maria a change of clothes so she could dress appropriately then for their trip to Ipswich. So, you know, she was going to dress like a man, go over to the Red Barn, meet up with Corder, change back into a more womanly attire, and then they were going to run off to Ipswich. But unfortunately, after leaving home to meet Corder, Maria was never seen alive again. Corder, however, he reappeared a few days later, and when people started asking, like, hey, let's do an accent here. I thought you took Maria Martin over to Ipswich. Where's Maria? I don't know what part of England that is, but it's something. Corder argued that Maria was actually in Ipswich, but couldn't come back out of fear of being arrested. For what? I don't know. Probably some dumb, you know, elope law. I don't know how English laws work. Corder eventually left town and began writing letters to Maria's family claiming that the two were married, happily living on the Isle of Wight. But people were still really suspicious, including Maria's stepmother, who continued actually having dreams. Well, she had started, and these dreams continued about Maria being murdered at the Red Barn. On April 19th, 1828, Maria's father and stepmother went out to the Red Barn and began digging in one of the grain storage bins after her stepmother had another dream of seeing Maria's ghost pointing to that particular spot in the barn. Guess what? They quickly found Maria's remains, and Corder was immediately named as the prime suspect, mainly because his green handkerchief was found wrapped around her neck. So pretty obvious there. Corder was easily found and arrested despite running off to the town of Brentford, getting married to someone else, and running a boarding home. Despite denying the charges, Corder was taken back to Suffolk to await trial, which began nearly 4 months later. This trial quickly gained national attention because Martin's body had basically been discovered by a dream. Like, that's crazy. Like, no one knew where she was. But Maria's stepmother, like, was like, I keep having these dreams that Maria's getting murdered at the Red Barn. We've got to go to the Red Barn and find her body. You know, that's probably how she sounded. Hordes of people scooped up hotel rooms and gathered outside the courtroom to await news of the trial. Corder, however, he pleaded not guilty. And to make things worse, coroner couldn't figure out how Maria had actually died because, A, Corder was arguing that Maria had actually shot herself with his pistol after the two got into an argument. Other people, probably like you, are thinking, well, no, she probably strangled herself to death. Or, you know, or not strangled herself, but was strangled to death. Hence the handkerchief around her neck. Maybe. I don't know. That's what I thought. The jury disagreed with Corder's argument and sentenced him to death. After spending 3 more days in prison, Corder obviously confessed to the murder. And then he was immediately hanged in front of as many as 20,000 people because, man, the world used to be so hardcore back in the day. Just like going to a public hanging was... oh, prime entertainment, you know? It's like, oh, what do you got now? Oh, you want to go to the movie theater? You want to go bowling? You want to go to a minor league baseball game? Pfft, screw that, dude. Let's go see someone get freaking executed. Heck yeah. I don't know. That's the other thing. Like, I could have easily sworn right there twice. I guess hell is not a curse word, but I don't know. It's so weird. I don't curse on this show, and I probably won't. because it's a family show. I don't know what kind of family would listen to this. I don't know what kind of parent you are if you let your kids listen to this, but I don't know. It's also fun to just say frick and just throw people off when they were expecting something else. Anyway, so yeah, that's the story of Maria Martin. We're actually going to check out a story in here in a little bit that's very similar. But first, we have the story of the Blue-Blooded Ghost. On October 25th, 1886, Georgia and Matilda Wilson arrived home in Mount Holly, North Carolina. So this is real close to where I live. Late in the evening, after they had spent a night out doing whatever 1880s married people did, who knows. While George was out back putting away their horse and buggy, he heard Matilda scream. So he rushed back to the house and found his wife lying unconscious in the foyer at the base of the stairs. He looked up to the top of the stairs and saw what looked to be a Union soldier bathed in blue light. The soldier's eyes had been gouged out and his left arm was a stump that dripped dark blue blood, hence the name the Blue-Blooded Ghost. When this figure lunged down the stairs toward George, he picked up his unconscious wife, which good for him. I don't know how many husbands would pick up their wife at that point, probably just bolt. But he ran back out through the front door. And once Matilda regained consciousness, she and George watched from the front yard as this figure moved through the house, frantically opening all of the cabinets and drawers in search of something that it never actually ended up finding. Well, the next day and for the next few days following, everything was back to normal. But then on October 25th of the next year, literally a year to the day later, George was awoken to the sound of someone walking down the hallway outside his bedroom door. When Matilda woke up, she thought a burglar had broken in, but when she saw the blue light shining through the crack in the door, as well as George's horrified face, she knew exactly who it was. This figure had come back a year later, exactly. George motioned to her to not make any noise, just shh, quiet. And Matilda responded by screaming at the top of her lungs because women do not know how to follow directions. Hey, that's a joke. That's a joke, all right? Women are great. That's a joke. Don't come at me, bro, right? However, Matilda's screams did not seem to bother the ghost, who just continued to rummage through the house for the rest of the night. The next day, George and Matilda made plans to start moving out. Well, the house stayed empty for 7 years until the Anson family from Tennessee moved in. Although they never reported seeing any sort of ghosts, when Will Anson, the family's father, died of a sudden heart attack on, guess what, October 25th, the family immediately moved back to Tennessee. They did not even come back to attend their father's funeral. What happened? And you probably know what happened. The next family, the Blake family, moved into the house in September of 1926. And guess what? A month later, on October 25th, Sam Blake was awoken by what he thought was a robber. He grabbed his shotgun and walked out of his bedroom to defend his home. But as he turned into the hall, he came face to face with this same blue ghostly figure. As he raised his gun to shoot, he felt something sticky on his foot and he looked down and saw drops of blue blood. Realizing that he was now dealing with something he could not possibly understand, Sam dropped his gun and locked himself in the bedroom. For the rest of the night, he listened as the figure ran through the house, opening all of the cabinets and drawers just as it had done with the other two families. And then when the same event happened again on October 25th of the next year, the Blakes moved out. This pattern continued to repeat itself for every family that lived there after that. The ghost has never attacked anyone, but it has only moved through the house, opening drawers and cabinets. Eventually, though, each family left the house. It became such a common thing that everybody knew about that each family actually started leaving the house on October 25th of every year to let the ghostly blue Union soldier do his thing. Who knows what he was looking for? Maybe it was his eyeballs, or maybe it was the rest of his left arm that was a stump. Who knows? But that is a thing. I'm not going to share the address of the house just because I don't want to be liable for it. But look, I mean, if you want to search the Blue-Blooded Ghost House in Mount Holly, North Carolina, I'm sure you can find the address. I do believe people still kind of go over to that house every year on October 25th to see if they can see something. Not a lot of recent reported sightings. I don't know when they stopped, but yeah, just an interesting story there. Our next story here is of the Greenbrier ghost, and it starts with Elva Zona Heaster. What a name. Was born in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, at some point in 1873. No one knows much about her childhood because no one really cared about the lives of women in the 1800s, especially in West Virginia. In 1895, she had a child out of wedlock, and the following year met a hobo named Edward Stribling Trout Shoe. Edward found work at James Cruikshank's blacksmith shop, and he married Elva soon thereafter. Everything went really well for the first 2 years of the marriage, but on January 23rd, 1897, Elva's body was found at the foot of the stairs of their house, lying perfectly straight, one hand on her stomach, you know, just like who falls perfectly straight, one hand on the stomach, like it doesn't, all right? Something fishy's going on. By the time the town doctor and coroner named George Knapp arrived, Edward had carried Elva's body upstairs and dressed her himself, you know, doing all the washing and other preparations for burial. Knapp examined the body while Edward held Elva's hand and cried. Knapp noticed some small bruises on Elva's neck, but when he tried to take a closer look, Edward got really angry and violent towards him and forced him to leave. It's a little suspicious. Elva's cause of death, get this, was initially listed as everlasting faint, which I guess is a thing that women did a lot of before doctors realized that, you know, women were subject to the same ailments men have. I want to stop right here. This feels like a very misogynistic episode. It's not on me, all right? I can't help that all of these stories are full of women getting murdered and fainting and just, you know, living up to some stereotypes. That's not me. I'm just, don't shoot the messenger, guys. This is just how it happened, all right? Look, women are great. I'm a fan, all right? I'm not even saying that because I'm married now. Like, you're great, all right? Keep doing what you're doing. Anyway, back to the story. The cause was then changed to childbirth. Cause of death was changed to childbirth, as Knapp had noted that he had been treating Elva for, quote, female trouble. Another great, just vague female ailment that doctors just did not want to deal with back then. No one actually knows whether or not Elva was pregnant at the time, but that's just what the cause of death was listed at. Elva was buried the next day, and during the wake, people noticed Edward's really strange behavior, which fluctuated between like extreme grief to intense happiness. It was like, look, not gonna lie, not very many funerals where people are happy. Right, funerals, in my experience, generally sad. Edward also stayed close to the coffin and did not allow anyone to get too close. He had wedged her head between a pillow and a rolled up sheet and then placed a scarf that he claimed was her favorite scarf around her neck. Mary Jane Heaster, Elva's mother, was pretty convinced, as we all are at this point, that Edward had murdered Elva by chopping her head off and then sewed it back on. Okay, maybe we don't think she chopped her head off or he chopped her head off, but we're pretty sure that Edward killed her. So after the wake, Mary removed the sheet from the coffin and tried to give it back to Edward, but he refused. She did notice, though, that the sheet smelled odd, and when she washed it, the water in the bucket turned red, which I don't know what kind of magic that is, where you take a white sheet and then wash it and then the water turns red. What sort of sorcery is that? The sheet also turned pink, and despite whatever primitive forms of bleach that Mary used to try to get rid of the stain, the color never went back to white. So Mary took this pink sheet as a clear sign that Elva had been murdered, and she prayed every night for the next 4 weeks for a sign from God, and finally she got her answer. So just like with Maria Martin and her stepmother, one night Elva appeared to Mary in a dream and explained how Edward had been really abusive in their marriage. And on the night of her death, Edward attacked her after he thought she had failed to cook him meat for dinner, which I get it, man. Like, if you're going to cook for me, I'm not doing some vegetarian crap. Like, no, I want beef. Or at least like some wings or some ribs or something. Like, don't emasculate me. all like when, like, I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, let's get back to it. During the attack, for thinking that he did not, or she did not cook him enough meat, Edward broke Elva's neck. And to prove it, in the dream, Elva rotated her head 180 degrees so that her face was pointing backwards. And that's a little freaky, especially in, you know, late 1880s when you don't have movies where this stuff happens all the time. Mary woke up and the next day tracked down John Alfred Preston, who was a local prosecutor, and pleaded with him to reopen the case because her backward-faced daughter's ghost would not stop appearing in her dreams. And look, I don't blame her. All right, if I keep having the same dream that my kid whose head is on backwards is like, hey, go fix this. I'm probably going to go fix it, you guys. Preston eventually relented and sent deputies to re-interview everyone who had been involved. And when Preston interviewed Dr. Knapp, he learned of the insufficient examination, you know, up there at first when Edward, like, made him leave, and immediately ordered an exhumation and an autopsy. So Elva's body was exhumed on February 22nd and placed in a one-room schoolhouse because, you know, West Virginia, that's how it goes. By law, Edward was required to attend. And 3 hours later, the autopsy was finished and revealed that Elva's neck was indeed broken and her windpipe had been crushed, which was a clear sign that she had been choked to death. And at that point, Edward was arrested right there on the spot. 4 months later, Edward went to trial, and Mary served as the main witness and repeatedly told her dreams to the court. Outside of someone actually seeing Edward choke Elva out, the jury thought that Mary's ghost dreams were the clearest form of evidence that anyone could possibly produce. Because of that, Edward was actually found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. And to this day, actually, this is the only known criminal case in which a ghost's testimony was used to make a conviction. So, like, yeah, like, so Mary, or Elva's, I guess, spirit, not really ghost, but spirit, like, kept appearing in her stepmom's dream or her mother's dream. And that's what got Edward convicted. Like, that's crazy, right? Next story here, a little bit of a short one, is the story of Old Book, which was the nickname given to a beloved staff member named Manuel Bookbinder at the Peoria State Hospital in Bartonville, Illinois. Old Book worked as a grave digger, and during funeral services for patients, he would lean against an old elm tree and weep for them, which, woo, that sounds like a terrible job. Like, I get it. Like, a lot of us end up crying at work anyway, but, like, when it's your job and, like, death is, like, a legit part of your job and you're sitting there mourning and weeping for people that you worked with or worked around on a constant basis, like, that just sucks. But anyway, Old Book did eventually die in 1910, and his funeral service was attended by hundreds of staff members and patients, both current patients and former patients, like the patients that, you know, were still alive, of course. But as the workers began lowering the casket into the ground, they realized that it felt a lot lighter than it should have. And at the very same time that they realized this, everyone heard a sound coming from the big elm tree that Old Book used to lean on, and it sounded like someone crying. Everyone then turned around to the tree and saw Old Book leaning against the tree just as he had always done. And a person who is named Dr. Zeller is listed here as attending the funeral. He later recounted the events in his diary and was so convinced that Old Book was standing against the tree that he ordered the coffin to be opened just to make sure. And guess what? They did. As the casket was opened, the crying stopped and Old Book's corpse was found just as it had been left in the coffin. So that's weird, but I don't know. Crazy. A few days after Old Book's funeral, the big elm tree actually began to die. And although several grounds crewmen tried to remove the tree because it was just dying and it was a nuisance, no one could actually do it. And it was mainly because they kept hearing a continuous, horrifying weeping sound coming from the tree. Eventually, though, the tree was struck by lightning and was able to be moved out of the cemetery. So, creepy, weird story there from Illinois. For the next one, we're going back to North Carolina, and James L. Chafin, he died in 1921 in the town of Moxville, and in doing so, he left his entire estate to his son Marshall, who was the third of his four children. Although the rest of Chafin's surviving family was shocked by the contents and instructions in James's will, they chose not to contest it, you know, whatever. That's just what happened. Apparently, Marshall was the favorite, and everyone else sucked. But 4 years later, James Pinckney Chafin, another of the Chafin who died's sons, told his wife that his father had been appearing to him in a series of dreams. Here we go with the dreams again. This one's not as gory as the other two. Each time his father appeared to him at his bedside, giving him that soul-crushing look of disappointment that parents give to their kids. You know what it is. Like, we've all gotten it. However, in the last dream, his father opened the black overcoat that he was wearing and pointed to an inside pocket. "You will find something about my last will in your overcoat pocket," is what James said before he, like, vanished into the blackness of the dream, I guess. So the next morning, James went to his brother's house the first chance he got and began rummaging through the attic to find his father's old overcoat. And when he finally found it, guess what? He opened the inside pocket, and just as his father had told him in the dream, he found a crumpled piece of paper with his father's handwriting. "Read the 27th chapter of Genesis in my daddy's old Bible." I don't know why. That's how I imagine ghosts talk, I guess. That's what the paper said. So James Jr., I guess, who at this point had to be thinking this was some sort of cruel, like, posthumous scavenger hunt, took his daughter Estelle and his neighbor Tom Blackwelder to his mother's house, where, after more digging through an attic, found the old Bible. And guess what, you guys? There in Genesis 27, they found a second will dated in 1919, which instructed the executor to divide all of James's land equally among his four sons. The surviving sons, which, you know, Marshall had actually already died by this point and left the estate to his wife, formally contested the will and made, and the family all came to an agreement, equally dividing the land among Marshall's wife and James's three living sons. Crazy, right? So many ghosts appearing in dreams. Because guess what? Here's another one. It's our last story here of Teresita Bassa, who was just a respiratory therapist at Edgewater Hospital in Chicago. She never really bothered anyone and just lived a simple, happy life in the big city, living the dream. But on February 21st, 1977, Bassa was stabbed through her chest with a kitchen knife, stripped naked, posed to look as if she had been raped, buried under a mattress and a pile of clothes, and then set on fire. Did you think I wasn't going to have a story with some crazy, gory details in it? No, it's kind of my thing. All right. After 6 months of interviews and investigations, police had no idea who had murdered her, but it was obvious she'd been murdered. The case went cold until police received a lead about another respiratory technician at Edgewater Hospital named Alan Showery. Police were able to trace the call, which led them to the home of Jose and Remedios Chua in Evanston, which is a suburb on the north side of Chicago. Jose, who was a doctor himself, told police that his wife had been possessed by someone named Teresita Bassa on three different occasions, talking about how she'd been murdered. And while that seems strange, even on the surface, neither Jose or Remedios claimed to even know who Teresita was, which, I mean, that's even stranger. And, hang on. I'm going to do something real quick. All right. Hang on. Just hang on with me here. Evanston, Illinois, and then Edgewater Hospital. I guess it's this one. It's like 7 miles away, I guess. But still, it's a huge city. That was a complete waste of time. I thought I was going to make a really big point there. Anyway, I was going to prove this story right. Now I'm skeptical again. But according to Remedios, a voice in her head told her that Alan Showery visited Teresita's apartment to fix her television, but then ended up stabbing her, robbing her, and setting the place on fire. Figuring that it was at least something to look into, police showed up at Alan Showery's apartment, who obviously he's going to deny any involvement in that. But after a brief search, police found two pieces of Teresita's jewelry among Showery's girlfriend's belongings. Showery's girlfriend insisted that Teresita had given them to her as a Christmas gift. But police didn't really believe her and took the items back to Teresita's family, who confirmed that they absolutely did belong to Teresita. When police returned with that little bit of information, Showery admitted to going to her apartment on the night of her death, staging a sexual assault and setting the place on fire because he was kind of short on rent and needed some extra money, but, you know, didn't really find anything. During the trial, Remedios was called as a witness and testified that Teresita had spoken through her, but all she remembered was hearing the name Alan and feeling cold and thirsty. Alan Showery argued that he had only confessed to the crime because police had given him false information and threatened to charge him with murder. And the trial ended with a deadlocked jury because, like, who are you going to believe? Like, a random woman who claims that Teresita's ghost visited her, or, like, the guy who's going to be like, no, man, I didn't do it? I mean, it's tough. It's kind of a lose-lose situation. But a month later, Showery's lawyers actually convinced him to confess to the murder, and he was sentenced to 14 years in prison. And that's great. But despite that, there's a very obvious question remaining. And namely, like, did Teresita Bossa's spirit actually possess this random person? Well, guess what? I'm going to burst some bubbles a little bit. As it turned out, Remedios did actually know who Alan Showery was, and she had suspected him of making formal complaints about her work quality that ultimately resulted in her getting fired from the Edgewater Hospital. Even more, Remedios' possession, quote-unquote, began on the same day that she had been fired from the hospital. But here's the thing. Despite that coincidence, investigators actually believe that Remedios didn't know anything about the actual murder, despite knowing Alan Showery, because she had never met Teresita Bossa before. She had no idea who this woman was. So that's weird. And that is also the end of today's stories. Ghosts, are they real? Some of these stories are interesting, you know. Do people in their afterlife come back and quote-unquote haunt people in their dreams, especially if they were murdered, to try to get justice? Who knows? But yeah, like I said kind of in the open, like, if ghosts really are real and there's, like, this weird kind of in-between to the afterlife, I don't know. Like, there's just so many potential rules that can be there. Do you choose to kind of stick behind for a little bit and go away, and kind of finish some things up? Or do you then just, like, go straight to the afterlife, whatever that may be? Who knows? It's crazy. But that's for another podcast to tackle. Let's see what we learned today.
What did we learn?
Number one, at least on three separate occasions, especially in this episode, spirits came back from the dead. Or I don't know if they came back or that's just where they went to begin with. But they helped people solve their own murders on three different occasions. That's crazy. Did that really happen? Who knows? That's the only, like, even remotely logical explanation for it. Because the people who came forward with that information were not involved in the murder to begin with. Crazy, right? Number two, there's a house in the greater Charlotte area that might be haunted, but only on October 25th, which is weird. I don't know why. But also, October 25th is a week away. Maybe I'll go out there and check it out and report back to you. I probably won't, but whatever. Number three, oh man, ghosts. Are they real? Maybe, but also I need to go back to number one because I said it happened three times, which it happened four times in this, but he wasn't, you know, James Chafin wasn't solving his own murder. He was just solving some legal issues. I don't know. There's no number three. Those were just kind of the two big things that we learned today. We're done here. All right. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've been all over the place this episode because I've had to sneeze, and stubbornly, I have not paused the recording. I've just kept going. So, like, I'll get distracted because I have to sneeze, but I'm going to try to hold it out and keep powering through it. But whatever. Next week on Our Weird World, we continue with our final Halloween themed episode, with stories about demons. Yeah. Last Halloween, we ended with the super scary story of David Parker Ray. This year, we're ending with stories about demons, which, depending on how religious you are, is, like, the scariest thing about Halloween. And so we're going to look at the stories of the Great Amherst Mystery, the Perrin family, the Smurl haunting, and Annalise Michelle, and the Snedeker family. So again, another big episode next week. Only 5 stories. Oh, sorry. But yeah, lots of demon talk. You know, maybe listen to that one during the day with the sunlight out outside. Don't listen to it in the dark at home by yourself. That's probably going to creep you out. Yeah, that's going to do it. I'm going to go sneeze and clear my nose out, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Tell all your friends and keep it weird. I tried to make myself sneeze, and now my nose is stuffed up. I hate my body.